here we go.
Welcome back to Here We Go with Todd McComas. That's me, Todd McComas, and this is Here We Go, the podcast where I get to just sit down and chat with my friends to get to know them even better than I already do, or to sit down with complete strangers just to get to know them, period. I've never met them before, and I love nothing more than sitting down and getting to know someone. And today, it's another friend who, by sitting down and chatting, I get to know a little bit better than I did before. And for you that have no idea who he is, you get to know him for the very first time. And I think you're really going to enjoy this one. But first, I will be doing stand-up comedy in Kansas City at the Kansas City Improv, January 29th and 30th. That show is on my calendar on toddcomedy.com. Please, if you live anywhere within a reasonable driving distance of Kansas City, come see me. I would love to make you laugh and then hang out afterward and have a beer and a little conversation. So, toddcomedy.com to get tickets to Kansas City Improv, January 29th and 30th. Go ahead and do that right now. Just pause this, go to my website, click the calendar, and then click event details underneath that show, and then look at the buy ticket button to get more show information or to buy a ticket. So for today's episode, it's a friend, very good friend, Steve Hofstetter. He's a stand-up comedian, and he's way more than that. He's got a lot going on. Those of you that do know him, you'll know him as a YouTube star. As a comedian, not just a YouTube star who does crazy shit and is famous for that, he is famous on YouTube as a stand-up comedian. So it's interesting to me because I've been his friend for a while. And to now see the level of fame he has accomplished by use of social media is incredible. Very proud of him. He has these heckler videos that took off and went viral and continue to do so. So if you pass somebody on the street casually and you say, do you know who Steve Hofstetter is? If they do, 9 times out of 10, it's from those heckler videos and his YouTube content. However, he's a very talented stand-up comedian, and he was a mentor of mine. And more so, I would say, even on the business side of stand-up comedy. We were actually business partners for a few years in 3 different comedy clubs, along with my good friends, Chris Bowers and Tony Dierdorf. So I learned so much from the business. I got to help him with some comedy festivals. He used to produce a lot of comedy festivals that were great showcases for stand-up comedians and would help further their careers. But also, now he has started the Steel City Arts Foundation. And let me tell you guys, I'm excited about this. If you're a consumer of the arts, be excited. If you are an artist of any form, be excited. Because if there's one thing I know about Steve Hofstetter, the guy doesn't half-ass anything. This is going to be incredible for the arts community, not just in Pittsburgh. It's a national thing. And it's going to really help foster some careers for some young artists and to help further careers for some older artists. And I'm very excited about it. I'm very excited for his success up to this point. And I'm very excited for you to get to sit back for an hour and learn a little more than you did before about my friend, Steve Hofstetter. So without further ado, here we go.
Here we go. Here we go.
Steve, thanks for being here, buddy.
Yeah, happy to do it.
Yeah, well, you know, you have so much cool stuff going on right now, as I just listed in the intro to this thing. So I want to start with, you know, how you got here, because I'm very happy for your success. You're crushing it. By the way, you're encapsulating right now the new measure of success for comedians and entertainers, I think. Would you say that's justified?
You mean because I'm not on TV?
Yeah.
You're making but things are still going well.
Right. Exactly.
It's a different world now. It is, you know, we don't need some white guy in his 60s in a suit to decide what should be shown to people anymore. People get to decide. And, you know, and that's what I've been leaning on. I've been leaning on the digital world, which is truly democratic.
It is. And it's beautiful to see someone doing it completely on their own. And it, because of you building this on the internet and through YouTube, you're now internationally known. And I just said that it must be overwhelming because it happened so quickly. But you would argue it didn't happen quickly.
I do not think this happened quickly at all. I've been doing stand-up for 18 years. I've been posting stuff on YouTube since 2006. It has been gradual. Not only has it been gradual, but it's been ebbs and flows. I had something go extremely viral in, I believe it was 2015. And then, you know, there was a dip for a little bit. And then I started hitting on Facebook in 2018. And then I started hitting on Instagram and Twitter this year. So it has been gradual. And it's also been, you know, it's been a struggle. I had to learn how to use these platforms. You know, it's not one of these things where like, oh yeah, just throw something up on Instagram. If it's good, great, it works. It's like, no, you have to learn what will work on these platforms, how to adjust the content you already have in everything from aspect ratio to length of time to just for that audience. And that's how you start hitting.
Oh, so were you constantly just living in the analytics and just, oh, this one worked. Why did this one work? This one didn't. What's the difference? It was just a constant adjustment from that data.
Not constantly, but it's something you have to pay attention to. And it's something you keep learning as you go. You know, one of the things I learned this year is when a post doesn't work, take it down. Okay. And I was always under, you know, I would operate under the idea that like, oh, taking it down is giving up, leave it up there without knowing that it hurts your overall engagement score that they have. And so like, if something is not working, admit failure and take it down and maybe figure out a better way to phrase the joke you wrote or a better intro to the video or whatever it is. But it's okay that something didn't work. There's a phrase in literature, kill your darlings. And it means like, don't be afraid to edit something. And it's also true when you're posting stuff online.
Wow. Okay. So I need to go back. Anything I put out at 2 a.m. because it felt important to me at the time, get rid of it because only 4 people got to see it.
Not necessarily. I mean, the time zones to me, that's one thing that I disagree with people on. A lot of people are like, oh, what's the best time to post something? Doesn't matter. I truly think it doesn't matter. I have had stuff go viral at all hours. Now, look, if you're posting stuff about American politics, maybe post it while Americans are awake. But if you're just posting a general joke, I mean, the thing that I had that went more viral than anything in my career was a video that I uploaded overnight. And it was a British kid who posted it to Reddit. And then it just built a ton of steam. And when I woke up at like 6 a.m, because I was in Florida going to spring training. We were waking up early to drive across the state to go to a different park. And I woke up and I looked at the video and I was just like, holy shit, what just happened? And it happened overnight.
Wow. All right. So ever since I've known you, and I've known you ever since I was an amateur, by no means even close to being a professional in stand-up comedy, still farting around part-time when I was a cop. And right away, I mean, I just noticed because I liken myself as a hard worker. Work ethic always paid off for me in my other career and anything I'd ever done. And right away I noticed like, oh, there's a difference. Like a lot of these people that are comedians are calling themselves comedians, just kind of float by the seat of their pants. And they expect that the world's going to come to them when they're ready and pluck them from where they're at and thrust them into fame. And you were always out working everyone. Did that come from your upbringing or can you even pinpoint it? Were you just always that way?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I was one of those kids that was like, you know, trying to sell baseball cards when he was 10. You know, like I was always that. And I think it's because I saw freedom as important to me. And I saw money as a way of achieving that. You know, I grew up without much of either. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I wanted to get out of the neighborhood I was in. I wanted to get out of the situation I was in. You know, my parents were, you know, they loved the hell out of us, but not each other.
Okay.
And, you know, and they were fighting a lot, and they started getting separated when I was 12. It didn't kick in until I was 15. That's when the divorce started, and that didn't finish till I was 18. Just one of these things of just constant, we don't really know what the next thing is. And then we moved around a lot, and, you know, all within Queens, but, you know, still a bunch of different addresses, two apartments in the same building. And I just saw work as a way to get out of it. And I think that that just took hold. And especially once I was doing stand up, because it's very easy to, you know, it's very easy to stay put, and I never wanted to stay put. And so I just kind of saw it as put the work in, and that's the way you can get out.
That's very interesting to say that, because I'm going to look at myself for a second and my son's situation. So my son was a child of divorce, obviously. His mom and I got divorced before he was even two. And in the process of us each getting remarried, and she got remarried a couple times, I got remarried another time, a lot of moving around, new household situations for my son. And I didn't notice this until late into his teen years, but the kid just worked his ass off to have his own money and his own shit. And then it finally, you know, as he became a young man and us living together and having these conversations, you know, finally it came out, and he was like, you know, I was wanted my own stuff that no one could ever take from me. Because, you know, yeah, when you would move me, and man, I mean, it used to make me cry, because at the time I wasn't doing it, you know, with that in mind as a parent. I was just like, oh, you know, I want to be with someone. I want a bigger, nicer house from him, but didn't realize I was always uprooting him. And his bedroom wasn't his bedroom anymore, and his things weren't necessarily his things anymore. He was sharing them with new kids and all this stuff. So you saying that, I mean, I think that is a very powerful motivator.
It is. It's, I mean, the reality of it, and, you know, please take this in the best way that I mean it, is he probably got that work ethic because he didn't trust you to give it to him.
Yeah, no, yeah, and exactly what it was.
And it's something that, as my parents fought about money a lot, you know, the way that I put it is, you know, we were never starving, but I remember being hungry, and I never wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And I remember how many fights that my parents had that started over money. And the idea of bills being a nightmare instead of being annoying. You know, when a bill comes when you have money, it's just annoying because you have to file it.
Right.
When a bill comes when you don't have money, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that. And for a lot of my life, boy, did I have that. Because when you're doing stand-up, you know, I mean, there was, I think the worst it got was I was $68,000 in debt at one point.
Wow, Steve.
And yeah, and it was, that was because I always believed it was going to work. And to me, if I had to put something on a credit card to make it work, you know, I wasn't going to shut off my heat because I couldn't afford to pay the heating bill. I was just going to put that on a card and deal with it, because I wanted to sleep, because if I couldn't get sleep, then I couldn't get work done. And then I would never be able to get out of that cycle. And it's not advice I would give everyone, because A, you have to be in a career where you have a high enough ceiling that you can get out of that cycle. There are a lot of jobs where you get paid what you get paid, and that's just how much it pays.
Sure.
You know, with a comic, it's such a weird thing because, like, it's just 90% of comics are poor. But the second you stop being in that 90%, then you're fine.
Yeah.
Like, it's a very it's a very weird, like, with other jobs, it's one of these things where you get, you know, a 5% promotion and it means the world to you.
Right.
And, like, it's so weird. And I'm not at the tipping point yet, but I – oh, wait. Todd, did you hear that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear any sound if you're talking about an external sound.
Yeah, that was really weird. I'm hearing Siri talking to me.
Oh, really?
That was very, very weird. My Siri on my computer just started up for no reason. And all of a sudden, someone just goes, just a sec. And I'm like, what is that? Yeah. So apparently I said something that triggered the robot overlords. But the, you know, the idea of, you know, of digging your way out, you don't want to create too much of a hole. And, you know, and there are a lot of people who it's tough because the thing that you need to do to make it is invest in yourself. But you also need to be honest and understand when that's a good investment. And it isn't always. And so one of the dumbest things I ever did was one of the smartest things I ever did at the same time, because when I was living in LA, I needed a car. And I was looking at these used cars and they were like $2,000. And I was like, I don't have $2,000. I can't do this. And they were pieces of shit. And I was talking to a friend of mine and she was like, well, what car would you get if you could get any car? And I was such a road dog at the time. I was like, well, I need something with gas mileage. So I'm going to get a Prius. You know, it was one of the, at the, this was 2005. There were no other hybrids.
Right.
And so, this is my excuse for actually wanting that car. And so I told her that and she goes, well, why don't you just get a new Prius then? I was like, cause it's $25,000. I don't have $2,000. And she goes, well, if you could finance it, could you pay for it? And I was like, I don't know. And I ended up thinking about it and I decided to do it. And it was the dumbest and the smartest thing I did, because on one hand, what a gamble that was.
Sure.
But on the other hand, it made me work.
Yeah.
And when it made me work, you know, I paid off that 5-year loan in 2.5 years.
Wow. Now, see, yeah. this is something you would hear a lot of father or motherly advice against what you're saying, right? That's traditional yes. thinking. I mean, that's
yes.
But they came from an era where and people still today mostly live in this, and this is true for them, that stability is the only way to secure your future, right? And yeah. But it's not true in this world. I do find it interesting that you ended up in this world, because you are one of the smartest people that I know of. Thank all you. My friends. And you went to school where?
Columbia.
Okay. That's what I'm talking about. And so I would think that there was a lot of pressure that you would even put on yourself, because I'm sure you had friends that were going and I know this, that, you know, were creating startups and all this and doing so well, venture capitalists, you know, whatever they're doing. And then you could have easily gone into that world. But for you, you know, to do what you did, I mean, what in the fuck were you thinking?
It's a great question. A lot of my friends, you know, in graduating went to work in finance.
Mm-hmm.
And so my best friend from college went to work for Goldman Sachs, and he got a 5-figure signing bonus, and his first apartment out of college was this gorgeous 2-bedroom on Broadway in 86 with a roof deck, like the kind of thing that if you work your ass off in New York, you might get when you're in your 50s.
Right.
And he's got it when he's 21 years old. Whew, and he gave it up and he gave the signing bonus back and he's a teacher now.
Really?
Because he realized he was never in that apartment.
Mm.
He had it. but he was never there. And his friends were never there. And he could never show it to anybody because he was always at work. And wow. So, yeah, he could have, if he slaved his ass off doing something he didn't believe in, he could have been wealthy in his 30s. But there's also something said for quality of life. And the way that I always saw stand-up, and there are two main ways to make it as a stand-up. There's New York or LA, and there's the road. If you're doing the New York or LA thing, you basically starve until fucking Siri again. Sorry. You basically starve until someone discovers you. Or you're working a job you don't believe in to try to pay your rent while you're going to the clubs at night and you're exhausted and you have no social life and et cetera, et cetera. And you're doing that for years until someone discovers you. I saw the road as a better way of doing it because it takes longer, but you'll enjoy the ride more. Because in doing the road, you actually do get paid to do it. You actually can afford to eat. You are doing longer sets. You're only concentrating on stand-up. You're not, you know, filing paperwork during the day and then doing stand-up at night. Like, you're just doing stand-up. And you get to do it professionally. And yeah, you do it in some shitholes and you risk your life a couple of times. But like you just overall, the quality of life was better. And that's something that I've thought about a lot throughout my life. The idea of in our parents' generation, you go to school, you marry someone, you set up a life wherever you happen to be, which is usually where your parents happen to fuck. You know, it's maybe, you know, your company moves and so you move or whatever it is. But a lot of people just, you know, stayed in the same place and they had those lives because those were the lives that were handed to them. And what we really should be thinking is, what do we want our life to be on a daily basis? And then work back from there. Because the goal isn't, oh, I want to be a stand-up. The goal is, oh, I want to spend my day writing and talking to friends and shooting the shit. I want to spend my nights doing shows. I want to be able to walk my dog in the morning, have a nice cup of coffee. Like, that's what I want. It's not that I want to be a stand-up. It's that being a stand-up affords me what I like to do. And so that's why I like being a stand-up.
Well, you had a lot to do with my decision to leave where I was at, and not the police force. I mean, Pat McAfee had everything to do with me leaving the Indiana State Police, but leaving the Pat McAfee show and going on my own. You had a lot to, whether you know that or not. I mean, you know, you and I had.
I didn't know that till just now.
But we had conversations, right? And I would always pick your brain, and you were always willing to let me do that and whatever. But watching you through the years, I thought, wow, you know, Steve, I had seen you when you weren't wealthy, you know, you were doing fine. I mean,
I'm still
not
wealthy, Todd.
Well, sure, but I'm, you know.
But you were. I was I'm moving to Pittsburgh now, and I had a 2-bedroom condo in the Valley. Like, I'm not, you know, not wealthy. I'm just, I'm not wealthy. I'm just not worried.
Right. I guess what it meant was you were able to live where you wanted to live and you didn't miss meals. Yeah. But, you know, you weren't living a luxurious comedic lifestyle. But yeah, I saw you always working on the next thing. Like, you never stopped. You'd gotten that opportunity with Fox where you ran Laughs. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a stupid name. It's the most generic name the show's ever had. And by the way, quick aside, the reason it's called Laughs is because their first suggestion was calling it ROFL. And so then when they suggested Laughs, I was like, fucking fine. That's fine.
But it was a great concept. It was a great show. And it ran regionally in markets. And, you know, I was like, oh, and it just didn't work out for whatever reason. Most shows don't. Mm-hmm. And but you were not dissuaded by it. You were like, oh, okay, fine, I go to the next thing. And you ran these great festivals, and I just saw you work. I get to spend a week with you at the New York the festival in New York that you ran, and watch you not sleep. You would micro nap. I mean, because you were always working. You're like, I'm just going to shut my eyes for 5 minutes and then I'm good for another few hours. And just that drive and seeing you never stop, but enjoying so much what you were doing. So when I began to figure out for myself that I don't enjoy talking about sports 24/7. I don't enjoy studying it like the other people that I see that thrive on it and just love it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, I'm in the wrong place. You know, all the guys I worked with, love Pat forever. All that, but I was like, I'm different and this is their dream and I'm just in their dream. Isn't my dream. But so after I had one conversation with you, I paced in my backyard in circles and we talked. And then shortly after that, I was like, I'm just going to do what Steve did. You know, I know in my mind there are things that I want to do. And as long as I can afford to do them, I don't care how much money's left over. I want to be doing day to day what I want to do. And I have you to thank for that.
I didn't know that. I thought I was just having a conversation with my buddy Todd, you know, I didn't know how, and that also brings up a good thing, which is, you know, sometimes you don't know how important the words you say to someone are to them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't know that I had that kind of impact for you. It means a lot for you to say that to me because I'm really proud of what you're doing. And you know, your point about like, okay, you know, you realize you didn't want to talk sports 24/7. So before Laughs, my first job in TV was a segment producer on a show called Dish Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And Dish Nation is or was, I don't think it's around anymore, an entertainment news gossip show where the basic idea of it was radio teams from around the country and they would talk about, you know, TMZ-esque stories, and then they would do jokes that we would write for them. You know, sometimes they would write their own, but, right, you know, most of the people on the show weren't comics. And so I was a segment producer on it, and, you know, and it paid well, but I had to get up at 3 a.m. And yeah, it was because it was a daily show and they had us come in. We had to be at work at 4.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. And I was, you know, half hour from the studio. And so I would be awake at 3 a.m, you know, try to force myself to sleep around 8, and which was very, very difficult to do. And then study garbage, like absolute garbage. There was one segment where it was when gay marriage was legalized. And that's a big deal story. And so I was like, okay, what's the entertainment angle on this? Wouldn't it be funny to do a bit about, you know, about celebrities who all said, oh, we're not going to get married unless gay marriage is legal. Now what's their excuse? And so I was like, okay, write that bit. And like none of the hosts delivered it. I was like, all right, damn, well, we can't even attack this well. Right. And then there was another story about the woman who wrote 50 Shades of Grey. And how she was just at a party where Robert Pattinson was there. And so she tried to cast him in the movie like by herself. And then so I was like, OK, let's do a joke about how like who else is at the party. And she just keeps walking over to people and be like, oh, Henry Cavill, you'd be perfect for this. And the executive producer was like, yeah, and then we'll show Henry Cavill with a shirt off. And I was like, what? No, that's not the joke. Oh, God damn it. And then the day that I knew it was over was I woke up. And I had a dream where the Kardashians were in my dream. And I was like, this isn't me.
Yeah.
I don't care that I'm getting a producer credit on a television show. Fuck this. This is right. Not me.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that was my last day on the show.
Wow. But, you know, it's great to pick up things because I know, you know, I'm sure you learned a lot from being there that you could take on mm-hmm. to the next thing. And I feel the same way. But I do know that, I mean, nothing has come easy for you. Like, I know that. So I think when people now, new people discovering you, let's say, and they're like, oh, this guy's huge on YouTube. Look at this. You know, I think that can get lost, you know, like the journey that led to these new people finding you so easily.
Well, there's that. Oh, sorry to interrupt.
Well, I was just going to say, now you have this Arts Foundation, which is one of the greatest things I've seen happen to the arts community in a while.
Thank you.
And maybe that's just because it's close to me, but also it sounds really, really cool. But do you plan to take that attitude into there? Because I feel like that's one of the greatest things you have to pass on to people.
Well, first of all, thank you. There's that old quote that my overnight success was 10 years in the making. Mm-hmm. There are no overnight successes. I have a theory that the idea of discovery is perpetuated by people who want the credit for your hard work. Even when I was talking about the idea before of like, oh yeah, you languish in obscurity in New York or LA for 10 years until someone discovers you. What are they discovering? They're discovering a decade body of work. And so the idea, discovery is a myth. It is constant small breaks, maybe a big break, but even that big break doesn't change everything because you still have to earn that big break. You know, our industry is littered with the bodies of people who are former cast members of big shows that nobody cares about anymore.
Right.
Because you do have to turn each thing into the next thing. And I get asked often at shows, or did when we still had shows, but when I would do live shows, I do a Q&A at the end, and I often get asked, you know, questions about, oh, what do you do when you're starting out? How do you start out, et cetera? Every single person who has asked me that question at a show, the first thing I say to them is I say, how often do you get up? And every single one, once a month, once every 2 weeks. Be like, cool. Could you be a doctor if you went to med school once a month?
Right.
No? Well, then why do you think you could do anything else?
Right.
Like, and what a lot of people don't realize when it comes to the work that it takes to succeed in the entertainment industry, let's talk about med school for a second, okay? To become a doctor, you have to be pre-med in college. After you're pre-med in college, you have to go to medical school for years. After medical school, you become a resident. After residency, finally, you become an actual, real, respected doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So what did that take? 7 years? 7 years of working your ass off and paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for education. What do the top doctors in the world make? A couple mil a year, right?
Right.
What do the top comedians in the world make?
Yeah.
Drew Carey made more than that the day he sold his show into syndication. Like the ceiling is higher. So why wouldn't the work be just as much, if not more?
It's a great way to look at it. I mean, it's true. I mean, no one that is at that level just came by it. I mean, it didn't just show up on their door. They did something different. They did something. They worked harder. Opportunities are created for sure. They don't just show up. And I feel like part of the reason I'm so happy about it's, and don't let me say it wrong, Steel City Arts Foundation. Yeah.
Steel City Arts Foundation. Yeah. Steel City AF.
Which is a beautiful name, by the way, because when you see it, like, oh, and especially in Pittsburgh, it's like, oh my God, Steel City AF, let's go.
but then, thank you.
You know, it's for the arts community, and it's I'm losing my point, but I know that you will be a great gatekeeper for these people because it's not like let's say someone who did, you know, had a 15, 17 year run on a great TV show and hasn't done anything in 10 years and just shows up and runs the thing. It's different, right? You're self-made and you continually move. You're like a shark.
Well, the thing that I appreciate all that, and one of the biggest advantages when it's going to come to running this place is that we don't need to do anything. I'm doing this because I want to. I'm doing this because it's in the memory and hopefully legacy of my father. It is, you know, I'm doing this because it's something that I think I will enjoy. I don't need to put up with any bullshit whatsoever. And we're not worried about making rent. I bought the place. So, yeah, we have to make the mortgage. But I was living in L.A.
Right.
Like the mortgage on a 15,000 square foot building in Pittsburgh is the same as it was on a 2-bedroom condo in the Valley.
Right.
And so like this is just a thing that I get to do. And because of that, there are going to be a lot of people who are going to be upset when I say no to them. And some of those people are going to put the work in and come back. And some of those people are going to blame me for not understanding their genius. And I'm not going to care. Because the reason, by the way, that like the reason that we saw potential in you when you first started is because you were someone who was putting the work in. And it's not just a question of, okay, who's got some good jokes when they're starting out? It's who has the ability to recognize the jokes that do work and that don't, and who wants to fix the jokes that don't. That's what we're looking for.
Yeah. Well, why give back at all? Because you have experienced so much flack from people and you've done nothing but, I mean, I don't know why. I have a saying that people ruin everything. Like you could come out with the most benevolent gift. Anybody any of our world leaders could come out with the most benevolent gift. And then 70% of the population would be like, oh yeah, but they're just doing that for themselves, or, you know, like, and they ruin it. So throughout my entire relationship of knowing you, you started a grant that just helps struggling new road warrior comics, you know, help them make ends meet. And it was in your father's name, and which is awesome. And then you would throw these festivals to try to, you know, showcase people. You bought into 3 comedy clubs so you could help book people. And I don't know what people thought, that you were making no money. You were bleeding money into those clubs. Yeah. What keeps you going? Let's discuss why in the first place that you have this innate need to give back to the industry that you work in.
I think one of my favorite moments in comedy was when we opened The Laughing Devil in New York. And the first week we did it, we had an open mic. And the way we would do our open mic is there would be like, so we did 2 open mics. There was the Wednesday one, and that was like done as kind of a contest. And the idea was that the winner would then get a guest set on a future show. And then we also did a feedback mic where people would come and perform for 3 to 4 minutes and then get 1 to 2 minutes of feedback. It was up to them. And our first feedback mic, Danny Jollis was there, and he was just starting out. And I thought he was funny. And I was like, hey, come to our Wednesday. And he came to the open mic on Wednesday, and he did not win. But I liked him way better than the winner.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, hey, I still want to give you a weekend spot. You know, you were funny. I'll give you a guest spot. And he came and did the guest spot, and he was funny. And after the show, I said, you know, here's the info to send in your avails. And his face lit the fuck up, because I was the first person who had ever asked him for his avails. Now, I didn't know that when it was happening. Right. I just thought he was funny. And I was like, hey, you're funny. I want to see more of your stuff.
Yeah.
But I will never forget that expression. I will never forget the look on his face. And over the years, seeing that is just, it's awesome. It's, and look, I'm not going to pretend it's altruistic. I like knowing that I'm responsible for part of good people's success. You know, I like
sure,
that.
Sure.
It makes me feel good. But like, I think it started in college when in high school, I had to do a certain amount of community service in order to graduate. We all did. But they would accept hours for the most ridiculous things. And so, like, I managed the high school softball team, and that counted. So, like, because I was volunteer coaching.
Okay.
And so that counted. And so I didn't really do, you know, that kind of anything there. But then when I got to college, you know, part of my fraternity, we would have these community service programs. And I got addicted to it. It was something where I went at first because I had to. And then eventually I loved it. And I started a program that is still going, by the way, which is, I love that it's still going. 20 years later, I started a coin drive. And all we would do is we would go room to room and just be like, hey, you know that stupid cup you throw all your change into? Can we have that? And we would we would do this coin drive. And the premise was that we would partner with a local teacher, and she would have her kids write, you know, and this was an underprivileged school, inner city school, and she would have her kids write to, you know, Santa, which as a Jewish guy, it was always funny that this was my thing, but the kids would write to Santa and then she would, you know, ask for a couple things for her classroom. And then we would raise, depending on the year, $1,000, $1,500, et cetera, in coins, go to a coin star, monopolize that for an hour. And then we would take the money and we would go and fulfill the shopping list. And as a kid who could never fulfill his own shopping list, it was so cool to be able to do it. And the thing that I would do each year, I always wanted to be the one that went shopping. Like, even though I didn't get to keep the stuff, I wasn't one of the ones that gave it to the kids. You know, I didn't see the kids' reactions. I was just the one going through a toy store going, let's get this and that and that and that.
Oh, nice.
And it was awesome. I loved it. And so I think it's just all an extension of that.
That's interesting. You just kind of happened into it and you were like, wow, this makes me feel great.
It does. It's addicting. I think helping people is genuinely addicting. And it does, you're exactly right that it comes with a lot of bullshit.
Yeah. And that's what always angered me. I mean, I've been in several disputes verbally with people over you, to be honest.
Thank you.
I mean, you know this. You've experienced, all your friends experience this. Because there is a lot of, he's not giving me opportunity. So, you know, he's bullshit, you know, whatever. And that's, I'm sure it's less now, but back in the day.
Now that I have bigger opportunities to give, there's way fewer people complaining. And
sure.
And it's some of the same people pretending that they were always on board. So stupid.
Yeah, it is stupid. But I just enjoy so much that you discovered this thing, because you said it's addicting. It's addicting for you. It's not addicting for everybody. I mean, that's giving back is something that you're just born with. I mean, I feel like there's just something inside of certain people, and the world's always been that way. There's an elite number of people that help other people in need. And, you know, it's charitable organizations thrive on those people. And it's always something that people like to think they're helping by every now and then, you know, me being one of those people before, you know, my recent years. Oh, once a year I give some money to these people. I'm doing my part. That's nothing compared to personally going out and making something happen, though.
But Todd, that's still part of it. And that's still an important part of it. And that's, you know, and don't be down on yourself for that. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you look at what the Laugh Factory does every year with Thanksgiving and Christmas, where they turn into a soup kitchen for it, basically. And every one of us that volunteers for it, we all post pictures of it. And it's, you know, good for our Instagram stories and all that stuff. But you know what it's also good for? That's also good for inspiring other people to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't give a shit why people are helping, as long as they're helping. And like I said, I'll be the first to admit that my reasons are not altruistic. I do it because it feels good. It is a selfish thing. I enjoy it. And that's why I do it.
Right.
But I think that the more people try it, the more that they will get addicted. I disagree with the theory that you're born with it or not. I do think that some people are born with no empathy, and those people can't do it. But if you're one of the, you know, 70-80% of people in the world who have some form of empathy, I think you will truly enjoy it. And especially if you could do charity in person, because it's so different to, I really enjoyed the shopping list thing and that was great. But then getting to actually see the looks on people's faces when you're helping is great, you know, and that's, that was something really cool about being able to do the stuff at the Laugh Factory. To go back to what you were saying though about getting shit, it's a bit of an extension of something I said earlier. There are two kinds of people who get rejected in the world. The people who look at that rejection and examine in themselves of how to get better, and the people who say, well, fuck them, they don't know.
Right. Which is easier for those people somehow. I don't understand.
It's a lot easier in the short term, but it hurts you in the long run.
Right.
And I will never get along with that group of people. I'll never get along with the people who say he doesn't know my brilliance. Of all the years, whether it was laughs or festivals or comedy clubs, I have turned down thousands of comedians. I've regretted it once. One time, Rory Scovel. I've told him this. He is my white whale. he submitted to headline Morty's early on, uh-huh. and I didn't think he was ready yet, and I was wrong. But every other, I could think of so many comics. Fuck you, you don't know. And I don't even think any of them are doing comedy anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
I think too, like if they just could separate themselves for a moment. That's why I enjoy having been part of those clubs so much, just because of I have a much more thorough understanding of how things work. Like many times, and when I took over booking for you, there were many times where I personally even wanted to book the person, but I knew I couldn't because it was going to be a poor financial strategy, if you will, you know,
absolutely.
At the time. And now I wish everybody could get a taste of that that's in comedy, because to take it personally, sometimes it's not that. Like, I enjoy you as a person, as a human being. I might even enjoy your comedy. I'm just making decisions that are best for the venue, so the venue can stay open, so it can provide opportunities to 52 headliners a year and 52 feature acts a year and 52 MCs a year,
yeah.
and have an open mic on Wednesdays to help cultivate the community. You know, all these things. And people are just quick. I didn't get my week. Fuck that club. Fuck that booker. You know?
Yeah, it is. It's a business, and you have to be able to do business. But also, what a lot of comics don't realize is, and this is something that is old hat to you, you know this, but you know, maybe someone watching or listening doesn't. Everyone knows there are 52 weeks in a year, but what people don't realize is that clubs already have a roster of 52 headliners.
Right.
Each year, five people on average change. One or two dies, you know, three or four get too big to do the week that they were going to do. So there's five shots. And there's 2,000 people applying for those five shots. So the idea, it's not only you're saying like, well, you know, how come I don't get to play professional football? You're basically saying, how come I don't get to be in the Super Bowl?
Right.
the chances are so low.
Right.
You have to be not just a great comic. You have to be, you know, a great comic or a draw or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And the odds are stacked against you, and that's okay. And so you have to be creative about it, and you have to get to the point. Steve Martin said it, be so good they can't ignore you.
Yeah. Well, and I agree. And then let's look at you, for instance. So if there was a point in your career where you couldn't become one of those five to replace, you know, the five that were leaving the roster at these big clubs or whatever, you were like, okay, well, I will go out. I will create enough of my following that I can come to your club on a Wednesday and go to that other club on a Thursday and the other club on a Friday and that one on a Saturday, and bring my own people and make way more money than if I would have worked full weekends for you guys. Right. So it's not like there's not another track.
The craziest part, Todd, is that so next August, I have a weekend where I'm playing the Wilbur in Boston, 1100 seat theater.
Yeah.
The Keswick in Philly, 1400 seats. There are clubs in each city that still won't book me.
Right.
that still wouldn't book me. If I said to them, you know what, instead of the Wilbur, I want to do your club. That would still go, I don't know. And you just have to, at a certain point, you just have to say, I don't care anymore. And yeah. So what I would do is, you know, I worked on digital stuff and I put out content all the time, you know, to the point where I was selling 20 to 30 tickets at a, you know, at a bar in a college town, or selling 50 to 60 at a comedy club on a Monday, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I kept building that up until I got to the point where I could start to say no to things. But I would also, I think one of the most important things was I was paying attention to what was working. And it's not just a question of like living off analytics. It's a question of trying to figure out what's next and listening to smart people and, you know, and taking advice from the right people. You know, Andrew Rivers was doing great things with Facebook ads, that, you know, he taught me a lot about that. And also Facebook video was something that there was a point in my tour a couple of years ago where Brett Druck and I sat down. We had kind of this come to Jesus conversation of like, fuck, what now? Because a lot of the YouTube, you know, YouTube had changed their algorithm and I wasn't reaching as many people as I was. And we couldn't just lean on that to sell tickets. And we're like, what else do we do? And so he was like, well, Facebook video has gotten a lot bigger now. And we started talking about that. And we worked on taking the video that was the biggest video that I had ever had on YouTube and formatting it specifically for Facebook. And then we posted it and it got 13 million views. Wow. And so, wow. You know, and that's how that happened. It was, we specifically were like, okay, what now? And there's, you know, there's a cliche that I love, which is necessity is the mother of invention. And it really is true. When your back is up against the wall, it forces you to think. And it forces you to go, okay, we can't just rely on this thing anymore. What's next? And the more you look around and you go, okay, what's next? The more you understand what else you have to do. And if, when it comes down to stand-ups, a thing I often wonder about is, why is it that a group of people who fiercely want to be original on stage are the biggest hacks when it comes to promotion? Stand-ups, we look around and we go, well, what's someone else doing? I'll do that. That is the opposite of what we do for a living. What we do for a living is figure out what other people aren't doing yet. And yet so many people can't seem to do that off stage.
Is there anything that scares you in life? Not, I mean, is there something that you, are you one of those people where if something does scare you, you're compelled to go do it? Or are there things where you're like, you know what? I'm not going to do that. I won't go up in an airplane and jump out of a parachute because I'm scared that fucking thing won't open. Or are you the type of person that's like, it does scare me a little bit, therefore I will go no matter if I believe that parachute's going to open or not?
I won't go in an airplane and jump out of it because I don't see the point.
Okay.
I don't see the point in the risk. I think a lot of life is risk reward. But I think the story that typifies it the most is I was on the road and I stopped to get some food, and we were in front of a Starbucks, and they had this enormous umbrella. This was in Central California, and so a lot of it's like outdoor seating, and one of these umbrellas, and I'm talking this thing is like, you know, 10 feet. And it had blown up out of the table and onto the roof. And this thing has a fucking spike. Like, if this thing falls, it's very dangerous. And you got a bunch of people standing around looking up at this umbrella. And I walk over and I'm like, what happened? Did the wind take the umbrella up there? And someone's like, yeah. And I was like, is anyone going to get it? And they're like, well, how do we get it? And I walk in the Starbucks and I go, hey, you guys got a ladder? And they were like, yeah. And I was like, can I borrow your ladder and get the umbrella? And they're like, I guess so. And I took the ladder and I went up onto the roof and I passed the umbrella down and they gave me a free coffee and I said, thank you. And I went on my way.
Nice.
And a lot of people are people who will just look at that umbrella and wish that it would come down safely. And that's never going to get that umbrella down. And it's not like it was particularly dangerous. Yeah, I went up on a ladder, but, you know, whatever. But it was just like, see the thing, figure out how to do it, move on with your life. So I'm not going to jump out of a plane unless there's a fucking reason. Now, if there's a reason, absolutely I'm there.
Okay.
So but if there's no reason, then why would I risk my life?
Okay. This is why I love this example, because I also won't do it. I've done some scary shit in my life, but I won't. I'm scared of heights. Now, I'll tell you, that's my one phobia. I don't like being on a roof. I don't like being on a tall ladder. And the reason I'm scared, though, I feel like it's very reasonable. I'm afraid of falling, right? Because I'm going to get hurt or I'm going to die. So therefore, jumping out of that plane makes no sense to me. Now, however, and people can judge me however they want. I don't give a shit. Like, for one, I'm like, but I've seen millions of you jump. I've seen your videos. You know, I'm not doing anything new or innovative. Well, I'm just going to jump out so I can say I've done it. On the other hand, even though I'm scared of heights or whatever, if in the military, they would have made my job paratrooper or, you know, Navy SEAL or whatever, and it was part of my job, and that's how I got to where I needed to be to go battle the enemy or whatever, okay, fine. I'll jump out of, because I see your point now. That's the only way I can get there undetected or whatever. I'll do it for, you know, but I find it so unreasonable that people say, I just want to feel that excitement, so I'll go pay to jump out of that plane with the dude on my back. That makes literally no sense to me. Like, you can't get that excitement doing something else where you might not die?
Yeah, I got the opportunity to throw a first pitch for the Brewers. And while I was there, I was joking around about, like, oh, is there any other cool stuff I could do? Because I was making a YouTube video about it. And they were like, well, do you want to go down the slide? Now, they have a slide in the outfield that is so high. It is so fucking high. The slide itself is like three stories, but it is above the stadium.
Oh.
And so, like, imagine going to the top seat in the stadium and then going up three stories to the slide. That's where it is.
Wow.
So I was like, now this is going to make a hell of a video, but also I'm scared.
Yeah.
But I realized, I was like, okay, look, it's got to be safe. They wouldn't let me do it if it wasn't safe. But also, like, this is going to be a good thing. And so I'm just going to fucking do it. And even though, and there are people listening and watching this right now who are fucking wiener. Like, it's every one of us. And you know what? I might be when it comes to that. But then also the person saying that might have imposter syndrome at the office. And I don't.
Right.
There are things that we are all scared of. And, you know, and the idea is that not only did I go down it, but I went down it holding my phone like this so that I could get a better shot.
Right.
And yeah, I was scared. But at the same time, I was like, this is what I have to do to get this done.
Yeah.
And so, like, and that's what life is. And that's what, you know, when people say, are you scared of going on stage? No, I'm scared of not going on stage. Like, are you? There are things that scare each one of us differently. I have never had a problem, you know, like, I'm a total wuss when it comes to cold. I think comfort to me is so important. And I fucking hate the cold and I complain about it all the time. And it's the one thing I'm scared of when moving to Pittsburgh and, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm the first one out of the car when there's a flat tire, regardless of how fucking cold it is outside, because that's what needs to be done.
Right.
And I think that if anyone who's watching this is worried about achieving a career goal or achieving a life goal or whatever it is, like, fucking do it. Like,
yeah.
That's the only, excuse me, I have a bit of a cough. That's the only way. It's not COVID, don't worry. It's the only way.
Plus, I can't get it through video stream, so it's okay.
Yeah, true. Well, I was hoping that you were worried for my safety, you know, but still. It's the only way. You just have to go do it. And it goes back to, you know, people ask me about being a comic, and then they're they're doing stand up at open mics once every 3 weeks. Well, and to those people, I'm just like, you don't want to be a comic.
Yeah.
Because if you wanted to be a comic, you'd be doing it more. You'd go fucking do it, and you wouldn't be scared of anything because it would be too important to you.
Do you worry about
Siri started again? What is happening?
Do you worry at all about what would happen if you were put in a position where you couldn't create or you couldn't entertain anymore? Because I worry about that a lot since I've fallen into this life. I don't know that how I would emotionally handle it. Like I felt like I lived in a prison until age 38 and didn't know I was in one. And then when I finally found this, I was like, oh, I'm out of prison. The world is way different than what I thought it was because I was born and raised in prison. I thought it was okay. I'm afraid to go back.
I was raised in the darkness.
Yeah, exactly.
I have often said that the day that I can't write anymore is the day that you pull the plug.
Yeah.
I don't get this whole, like, you know, hanging on to life when you can't feed yourself and you can't just fucking, it's you had a good run. It's fine.
Right.
It's so much of who I am and what I want to do and who I want to be. And it's not just create. It's always, you know, I get very distracted by the shiny thing and I always want to, a new project, a new idea, you know, et cetera. And, you know, the day that I can't do that anymore is a day that I'm done.
Yeah. I don't think people want to be around me anyway, if I'm trapped like that, like I think I'm gonna be pretty miserable, but, thank God for people like you that I found this because it's, it's just, you never know what you put on this planet to do until you just, you come across it and then, you know, and then you just never let go of it. And I feel like the world we're in now, that was always my thing. I had no idea, but thank God that I found it before it was too late. And you're one of the people that are very special to me in this industry. So I want people now to know that Steel City Arts Foundation, Steel City AF, is coming very, very soon. And where can they go to learn more about it?
So you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Steel City AF, or you can go to steelcityaf.com. We take possession of the building in February, and hopefully, you know, we can start taking applications for residents and members. It's kind of, for those who don't know, it's kind of like a comedy Hogwarts. It's going to be a little, you know, a little educational, lots of shows, you know, et cetera. So hopefully we could start taking those applications in March and we can actually open, assuming COVID can get under control, sometime in the summer. So that's
I'm going to put links in the episode description to all your shit, your YouTube, your website, everything. I assume everything funnels like a switchboard in and out of your website. So if all else fails, go to stevehofstetter.com.
I actually don't think I've linked Steel City on there yet. That's a good point. Okay. I got to do that.
It'll be there soon.
Yeah, I got to do that. It's too new. I'll save that. I'll use that as an excuse.
Dude, I want to congratulate you, first of all. And I'm glad that we got to talk one-on-one like this because I know we're both busy and it's been a while since we really, really had one out on the phone. But I wanted to let you know I've always appreciated your friendship, and I will continue to appreciate it as we go. And I couldn't be happier for your success. No one has worked harder for it, and you're very deserving. And we, as the comedy industry, are very, very fortunate to have you.
Todd, that means the world to me. You know, there are a lot of shitheads in our industry. There's a lot of people who I believe are in the industry for the wrong reasons. They're in the industry because they have a hole in them that they're trying to fill. Mm-hmm. And they're not in the industry because, like you said, you realize that you're in prison if you're not here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I call it, you know, finding out I was a comic was like being thrown in the ocean and finding out I was a fish. Mm. You know, I didn't know that, like, I couldn't breathe.
Yeah.
Until then, I was just flopping around. And there are very few people in this industry that I'm just like, that's a good one. That's a truly good one. And you're one of them. And I am very, very glad that, you know, you started hanging out at Morty's back in the day.
Yeah, me too, brother. Me too. And there's going to be so many great things coming out of Pittsburgh from Steve Hofstetter. please, please, if you don't already know him, get to know him and follow all his shit. The Social Distancing Social Club is such a fun show. I've been on it twice. Loved it every time. It really helped a lot of comedians get through what they were going through during COVID. And it's just an entertaining show. So if you ever get a chance to get a ticket and set in on that, do it, because I'm sure you've all seen bad shows done during COVID. This is not one of them. This really is set the bar very high and continues to do so. So check that out. It runs several times a week, and it's an easy, if you're not on the West Coast, it was an easy catch for people like in the Midwest, because it happens earlier in your evening. So it doesn't interrupt anything else that you might have going on with watching games or whatever in the hell. So,
well, thank you, Todd.
Yeah, absolutely, brother. Let's talk again soon. I look forward to going to Pittsburgh and checking out Steel City AF when it gets going. And let's have a steak or something, all right?
Hell yeah. Sounds good.
All right, brother.
Oh, here we go. Here we go.